Go with me, though, from Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, Executive Director. Good morning.
Good morning.
First, you wanted to talk about dog poop.
I do. I was in Round Valley last week, as I often am, and it's so wonderful and beautiful out there. But I noticed an awful lot of unscooped poop, and I was sort of horrified, to tell you the truth. There was a lot just right around the trailhead where there are bags that are supplied and trash cans that are supplied, and I would really encourage people to remember that it is a public area. We all share it, and it's kind of disgusting to see so much dog poop left unscooped. So, you know, I think... my mom used to tell me that character is when we do the right thing when nobody is watching. So I know sometimes it's snowing and maybe, you know, one of the beauties of Round Valley is it's not always very crowded. But, you know, please let's remember that there's a cumulative effect out there and there are bags and trash cans readily available. And help us all keep it nice, because I fear that if we don't really take responsibility for our own dogs, then it's going to be a lot harder to keep that area as an off-leash area.
Okay. Also, of course, the announcement that we have closed on the Oakley property.
Woohoo! Yay! Yes, we have actually now purchased 23 acres of land along the Weber River in the town of Oakley. We're very excited about that. I have to say a huge thank you to our many partners. We had 158 donations from individuals. We were able to even, you know, tackle this project thanks to the Conservation Fund, which is a national organization. And then we also had a number of local sponsors. The Rhode Island Diner out in Oakley helped us out by offering some incentives for early donors. We had a matching grant from an anonymous donor who we call Nana B. And, of course, we had program support from Vail's Epic Promise. So all of that was really fabulous. So now we own 23 acres. I actually had a group of people out there last week. It was magical. It was just beautiful. So it's a half mile of river.
And the deed owner is Summit Land Conservancy?
We do own it right now. Our long-range plan is to, there's a house already in existence on the property. It's been there since about 1964. Our plan is to sell off that house with a couple of acres that surround it to somebody who wants to have that house. The remaining 20 acres will become a public park. Now, in order to make that happen, we have some grant writing that we're going to do. We have partners, hopefully, lined up that will be successful for that, because we still have to pay off our loan. So the grants will help us pay off the loan, and that one of those grants we hope will also be the funding that the county supplied to the town of Oakley last week for the Weber River Corridor project. A portion of that money could be used to help make this a public park. So in the end, we hope the town of Oakley will own the land, the back 20 acres along the river, and we'll have a conservation easement on it that makes sure that there's always public access and angler access, and people can go out there and enjoy the open space in the river.
So the money that the Summit County provided was just a loan?
What Summit County actually set up a grant agreement. So no money has changed hands yet. But they set up a grant agreement and said if the town of Oakley finds ways to save open space or use this open space corridor out there, then there's a certain amount of money, $500,000 that's available for various projects if the town of Oakley approves them. So a portion of that $500,000 could go to helping us pay off our loan.
Okay.
And we've got some other partners we hope will help us also.
All right. Let's see. Bonanza Flat, not a done deal. And clock is ticking on this one.
The clock is ticking, and it's not a done deal. I was up skiing this last weekend, and I rode the chairlift with a lady who said, yes, I know all about it. It's saved. And I said, no, it isn't. It's not a done deal. There is a $13 million gap that has to be satisfied. And if that gap isn't pretty well satisfied, or there's good, strong pledges that say, yes, other governments and people are going to step up to help bridge that $13 million gap, the city's not going to be able to go forward, because the city only has $25 million. And so that's not enough to buy the property. So we have a deadline on March 15th, and that's closer and closer. I would encourage people to go to our website, wesaveland.org, or savebonanzaflats.org. There's a lot of information out there. Find out what the situation really is, and if you can help, please do.
Okay. How do they do that again?
You can go to wesaveland.org and designate Bonanza Flats.
Okay, let me think.
And if people want to make a bigger donation than sometimes people are comfortable making online, you can contact me via our website, wesaveland.org.
Okay, Cheryl, see you next month. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheryl Fox with the Summit Land Conservancy, KPCW News, KPCW News Time 820. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. The Summit County Council meeting tomorrow at the County Courthouse in Colville, starting in work session at about 1:15. In the studio, filling in for County Manager Tom Fisher, I have Health Director Rich Bulla, and on the phone with me, Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, County Manager Tom Fisher away, fulfilling his National Guard duties. Has the council or the staff ever had a discussion that in the event of an emergency and Tom was called up, what the chain of command would be here locally? Do you have any, Rich?
Well, I can tell you that, I can tell you that Tom sent out an email to that effect saying that any decisions or any actions that had to be taken, Brian Bellamy was the interim. And then, of course, the council has authority as well. So I feel pretty comfortable with the chain of command.
Okay. Let's see. Pat, the council will be interviewing four applicants to fill Doug Clyde's position on the Eastside Planning Commission. Of course, he was elected to the county council. One of the applicants, former planning director Don Sargent, does that present any potential conflicts?
You know, I think council will talk to Don about that tomorrow as part of their interview. When it comes to knowledge of the codes and knowledge of the issues and frankly the history of the Eastside community, no one can argue that Don doesn't have a deep base on that. Whether there's a conflict, I wouldn't comment on that, but again, I think council will ask that question, see what Don does in terms of responding to what he sees the upcoming issues that we need to wrestle with on the east side. I mean, I think that's really the majority where the questions will come from to all the applicants is, what do they see planning on the east side of the county looking like? Where's our opportunities? Where are our challenges? So we'll see what comes out of that discussion.
Yeah. And this is these are big appointments, given all of the potential development that could happen on the east side in the next, 10 years, I'm guessing, huh?
Yeah, every time we have a term come up for either reappointment or in some situations the term limits expire and we bring on somebody new, they're always key because we never tend to fully solve all the problems out there. When we fix one, there's always another one to be dealt with. Sort of on that conveyor belt. So I've always taken the position that every appointment is crucial. And thankfully, I think the council takes a lot of time to seriously consider how to best fill those open vacancies.
Okay. Let's see. Rich, financing for the sewer expansion project in Lower Silver Creek back on the agenda. Maybe you could explain this. From the staff report, it sounds like this has turned into a really complicated cluster here.
Well, unfortunately, it's been a challenge actually now going on 2 years. We have been successful in getting financing from the state, and it's a 0% loan for the amount of the project, $1,030,000. We're actually hoping the project comes in significantly below that, a couple hundred thousand below it. But the state granted that loan for 30 years with the assumption we would form a 30-year assessment area. It turns out that we cannot legally form a 30-year assessment area. So we're going back to the drawing board with the proposal to form a 20-year assessment area. That all sounds real simple, except that when you break the annual payments among the property owners up to 20 years, it's an amount that they can't afford. And it is a voluntary assessment, and so they voluntarily have the option of opting out of the project. So we're trying to find a way to maintain that critical mass, the number of properties that we need to get it done, and still make it affordable. And so in a nutshell, that's what's on the table. And the options really are a balloon payment at the end of the 20 years, or hopefully that would be offset with new properties coming on. We'd only need about 5 new properties coming onto the project, or potentially some contribution up front on an annual basis, either from the county or from the state or a combination.
All right. Have you seen anybody opt out as a result of this?
Well, we have not had a public meeting about this yet, but I have spoken with property owners, the majority of the property owners out there, and about half of them have said that if we go beyond the $1,760 annually that we had settled on with the 30 years, that they would likely opt out. And so obviously that's a huge concern, and this is a priority project, so we need to figure out a way to get it done.
Yeah. So what is that remainder after 20 years?
The total amount would be about, I want to say, about $160,000. Again, if we get half a dozen properties on board during the time, then it gets taken care of. It gets paid for. There's 36 total properties within the proposed assessment area. We currently have 20 that are on board. And so, you know, there's going to be growth out there. And one of the things that has slowed growth is the fact there's not sewer. And so it's kind of a chicken before the egg. If we can get sewer there, we're quite optimistic that we'll get the properties we need.
Yeah, but still you think, I mean, just setting aside 10 grand a year, that's not a big deal.
Well, you're correct. If the county opts, that's one of the options, that the county would perhaps pay an annual assessment into the pool of somewhere a little more, a little bit greater than $8,000 a year. There wouldn't be a lump sum at the end of it.
Okay. You say that this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to do this, and so you're fighting hard to make sure it happens.
I believe it is. If we don't get sewer out there, the state is not going to be welcoming to our requests in the future because they've made a generous offer, a 0% loan, and we need to get it done.
Yeah. Does this lead to any financial risk for the county, that shortfall?
Well, potentially, yeah. I mean, if the county decides to form the assessment area and takes on the roughly $160,000 balloon payment at the end. If we don't get new properties coming on, then yeah, there's a risk, and the county is at risk for that.
All right. Pat, back to you. East County Code Chapter 3, can you briefly explain what the purpose is of setting up, three new zones?
Well, a number of new zones. Tomorrow we're going to have a work session, not a public hearing, it's just a work session. And getting back to one of your previous comments about all the issues that we're wrestling with on the east side, this is emblematic of that. 3 years ago, the East Side Commission revised the general plan, and one of the key policy statements in that general plan spoke to the need to create more zones than currently exist in the code in order to achieve a number of things, deal with the growth that's anticipated, as well as create opportunities for the property owners over on the east side. Right now, the vast majority of the properties in that planning district are zoned with a very low threshold of density, one unit or one house per 40 acres or greater. There are some pockets of commercial and some light industrial, but the vast majority is zoned 40 acres or greater. What we've done to work through this issue with the Planning Commission is to propose a number of new zones. And the idea being creating opportunities in the right places to apply the right amount of density and be able to transition those in those right areas. We're proposing a 6-acre zoning, residential zoning. We call it an agricultural AG6. We're also proposing an agricultural residential 20-acre zoning. That'd be an AG20. We'll still have a 40. In addition to that, we're proposing a couple of new residential zones. One's a rural residential zone that would allow for someone to come in and propose a subdivision that would allow one unit per 1 acre. In addition to that, we're also talking about a brand new zone called a residential subdivision zone, which would allow 3 units per acre. When you go back to the original plats for some of the small towns, you know, communities on the east side, that 3 units per acre was that original density. We think this particular zone, bringing in with it, you know, the right amount of public infrastructure, you know, the water, a wastewater system, public streets, might offer an opportunity to put some residential densities in the right area. The other zone that we're proposing is kind of a unique one. You know, as planners, we talk about, you know, creating viable communities, and oftentimes it's hard to create that from scratch. Some of the best templates or frameworks that we have are the existing communities and the villages that are out there. We're proposing this new designation, this new zone. It's called a village overlay zone, and that's targeting unincorporated communities and villages such as Echo or Upton, Hoytsville, Wanchep, Woodland, Marion, are historical communities. What this zone would do with the county council, with the support of, you know, property owners, could designate a perimeter boundary for a planning area around some of these historical villages, and go through a master planning process that could create the opportunity to, rather than redevelop, actually recreate some of these historic towns in terms of residential densities, more of a mix of uses, bringing in some village commercial uses potentially. Need to emphasize this, that we see this particular tool as being sort of a cooperative joint opportunity between the landowners and the county council. Should all those pieces fall into place and everyone agree that this would be something we should explore, the county council could establish that perimeter planning area, and then we go in and look at densities and uses and infrastructure. So that's a relatively unique idea. We want to test it with the council. It seemed to have general support from the commission as well as the community. So tomorrow is going to be about just our first opportunity to explain these in their entirety to the council. We're going to follow up with a public hearing on these on the 1st of March. We haven't mapped any of these yet. The idea is let's first go into the planning or go into the county council, make sure they understand what the recommendation was from the commission. And then once we've had a chance to work through that, discuss the zoning map later. And although not agendized yet, my sense is we'll probably be taking up that topic in March.
Okay. The residential subdivision, you say, would require sidewalks and sewer. What about the rural residential? Is that sewer as well?
Actually, probably would depend on the density. The rural residential would still have to meet all of our subdivision standards. Would there be a possibility for those to include a wastewater system that would allow septic? It would really depend on the site characteristics of the property involved. Part of what will also play into this will be we've recently revised our subdivision regulations, kind of brought them up to kind of current standards, we believe. We've also proposed a master planning process that we think will be a useful tool, provide sort of some incentives and some flexibility for the developers and the property owners. We're excited to kind of weave these together and are looking for, you know, hopefully some action on this in the council in the upcoming month or so. We've been working on this for a really long time. You know, a lot of people are anxious to have some decisions made so some folks can move forward. It's vital at this point to still have an opportunity to have the ultimate users of this, the community, weigh in on some of these last fine points. But I think we're moving kind of systematically towards some decisions here at the end of the month and into March.
Okay, real quick, an ordinance that would allow some development on the East County on slopes over 30%, as well as geologically hazardous areas and ridgelines. The council did take a road trip on that. After that, did they direct you to make changes to this proposed ordinance?
Yes, I would call them more fine-tuning than changes. Again, to kind of set the discussion on this, this will be, we believe there may be action taken on this. Development on ridgelines has always been a tough issue to get our hands around. Everybody knows on the west side in the Snyderville Basin, it's been a big issue. Our situation is a little bit more complex on the east side, where we have a number of old platted subdivisions with lots in them. We have parcels, which we call lots of record, meaning the property owner has the ability to develop them. They go back a number of years, and many of these parcels have ridgeline characteristics. And when I say that, you know, if a home is built, there's always that potential for the home or the roof to project into the skyline. The way our code on the east side is written now, it's just outright prohibited. You can't build a structure or a home that extends into the skyline, period. The only way around that for the property owner is to go through a special exception process, which is expensive and time-consuming. What we're proposing here is to actually establish a process, take what we've been using on the west side and try to improve on that and use it on the east side. In this particular case, the process would be a low-impact permit. And low-impact permits are akin to an administrative conditional use permit with specific criteria. In this particular case, if a property, when viewed from a county or a state road within a two-mile radius, if it appears that that structure would project into the skyline, it would go through a low-impact review process. And as part of that process, there would be specific reviews of, is there another location on the property that would result in a better placement of the building? If not, how can the building be designed to minimize those potential visual impacts, reduction in height, stepping of the building massing, you know, the use of the materials, the lighting on that, and it would allow staff to work on that with the property owner. The check and balance on this is, in the event that there are issues or concerns or objections to that, whether from the property owner or, you know, the architect or somebody else that would have standing neighbor, we have the ability to take that low-impact permit to the Planning Commission for a review.
Okay, now, Pat, I need to leave it there. Okay. Come on, wrap it up.
I was just going to say, that two-mile radius, there is a small exception area for what we call that donut hole when those properties are viewed close up. The council had us reduce that down to a third mile. So if you are viewing that from the county or the state road within that third mile radius, that would be an exception. You wouldn't have to meet those standards. But we think this is going to be a vast improvement on what we have on the code now.
Okay. Thanks, Pat Putt and Rich Bullitt. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Park City Planning Commission meets tomorrow night, the first meeting of the month. It's usually dedicated to discuss the Treasure Project, but the project is slated for continuance. In the studio with details, I have Planning Director Bruce Erickson along with Planner Kirsten Whetstone. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So why are we continuing Treasure?
The applicant has requested us to continue the meeting so that they have a chance to put additional traffic information together. They're going to be doing traffic counts over the President's Day weekend and then correlating them to the previous studies that have been accomplished, and that's part of the review. So we've agreed that we would continue it. We will take public input, but the applicant and the staff will not make a presentation.
Okay, so will it return then for March's meeting?
It returns on March 8th and April 12th.
Okay, and just to talk specifically traffic.
Well, there's a number of things moving forward. Francisco Astorga and his team are working on the soils, excavation, blasting, and environmental component. We're working on the traffic and parking component as well. So the applicant has asked for time on the 8th and the 12th to talk about traffic, and we'll be moving the rest of those issues forward as well.
All right. 422 Ontario. This property is on the historic sites inventory, labeled as significant. Is this Shorty and Ella Sorensen's old house?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So we're deeming it significant just because it's been there for a long time.
Well, it meets all the criteria that we have in the Land Management Code for significant, and what this really is a steep slope conditional use permit. Anything over 30% slope in the historic district requires a conditional use permit from the Planning Commission, not the HPB. So it's a fairly straightforward process. That's why it's on the consent agenda.
So the application, the applicant wants an addition to the north side of the home. And what kind of changes are they able to make given this significance finding?
Well, whatever additions they need to make need to be subordinate to the House. They need to meet our historic district guidelines. I believe it's been through a historic district design review already, and I believe it's been signed off. So this is the steep slope CUP for construction and protection of the neighborhood from construction impacts.
Okay. Any outstanding issues, anything, for the Planning Commission?
None. This one's on consent.
All right. Also, looking at amending the Deercrest Master Plan Development and Settlement Agreement, I think the applicant is asking to suspend, well, not remove the physically disconnect the Deer Hollow Road before it builds the Slalom Village parcel. So, Kirsten, you want to explain?
Yes, that's exactly right. This is the third amendment to the settlement agreement, which was back quite a ways before the annexation of that area, the Deercrest area, that is basically east over the ridge, east of where the St. Regis is. And there's a road. It used to be the Keatley Road, so it was a county road. And during this whole situation with the annexation and the development of the Deercrest parcels, the county, there was a condition that was put in as part of the settlement agreement that when the Slalom Village, or Deer Hollow Village as it's called now, development was constructed, they had to do a physical disconnect of that straightaway, that road. And you could still get through from the east gate to the west gate through the neighborhood, which is the Deercrest Estates drive and wind through the neighborhood. But the applicant, Deercrest, and with the support of a lot of the Deercrest associates and also backed up with a settlement agreement release from the Queen Esther HOA that said they would agree to eliminate that requirement to disconnect the road, physically disconnect the road, with a whole bunch of conditions. And that had to do with who could come through the West Gate. And so that's still in place. This is just a request to amend that. And basically it also amends the master plan development for that whole area.
Right. So to continue with that just a little bit, because this is a little complicated, there are actually three gates in place right now at Deercrest. Okay. Those three gates will remain in place. And the biggest concern we have is assuring that those gates continue to operate in accordance with the Deercrest settlement agreement, in which there's a number of restrictions about who can pass through those gates. The road is currently open now where the disconnect would be, so the operations probably won't look a lot different than what currently exists out there. So the West Gate, which is the automatic gate on Queen Esther Drive, the West Gate, which is at the saddle, and the East Gate all remain in place should this decide to go forward by the Planning Commission and the City Council.
So this goes back to something I had raised over the Christmas holidays when we just saw huge backups and people weren't able to get anywhere, I mean, even emergency vehicles. And I asked, why aren't we letting people go out through Deercrest? Well, because the agreement says that we can't, but now there is some talk about whether or not we even want to discuss whether we should open those gates.
We're having those conversations, yes, as we move forward. Public safety, fire, EMS, and transportation all kind of advocate for allowing emergency situations. We don't know what an emergency situation looks like. We need to put a definition on that. There's some issues about how we manage going through the gate. There's some issues about whether we allow eastbound travel. There's some issues about who owns the road, who's responsible for snow removal. Not an easy discussion, but I believe we'll be able to sort through it over the course of the next year.
So isn't that easy to decide what an emergency is if a fire truck can't get to a house on Lower Deer Valley because of the traffic?
That depends. And no, that's not an easy situation because we don't know why the traffic is backed up. And, you know, traffic is kind of a funny thing. In order to support some of our other initiatives, we've decided that a slightly higher traffic conflict is appropriate. And so when we do things like walkability and we change snow removal and we do all those other things, transportation is affected. So all these things are a giant calculus of what we can and can't do. It'd be fairly straightforward for us to say, okay, you know, at X situation when the backup at the roundabout is 20 cars deep, we'll go ahead and exit out Deer Valley Drive. We'll see. You know, that's a private road. Deercrest has some input into it. Wasatch County has some input. Kirsten has an interlocal meeting with how many agencies today?
Oh, several. About eight entities from Wasatch County and Park City. to talk about basically this situation as well as any other issues that have come up, because that Deercrest development is actually in Wasatch County. It was annexed to Park City, so we have a lot of coordination issues that we try to keep up with on a annual basis as we can.
So it sounds like for now we'll allow the Slalom Village parcel to be developed?
Well, the Slalom Village is in the master plan and the annexation agreement. It has some development rights. It needs to go through our permit process. What we're saying is that we would not ask for a fourth disconnect at the Slalom Village. So there are three in place right now. The agreement calls for a fourth, and the applicant is saying the fourth one is redundant and not necessary.
Okay. Any staff concerns about that?
And the item is up for just a public hearing and then a discussion. We've identified several questions for the Planning Commission to discuss, and then we will bring it back. I believe it's scheduled for continuation to March 22nd.
All right. Kirsten, Bruce, anything else?
No, that's all. Thank you.
I did have one other thing, just in case you're interested. The Board of Adjustment is meeting on February 21st at 5 p.m. That's a Tuesday. And they are going to discuss the Star Hotel determination of significance, and that's the historic building, at least deemed by the city historic, next to the Imperial Hotel.
The applicant has appealing that decision.
Yes, exactly, or requesting a determination of significant to say otherwise.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Kirsten Whetstone and Bruce Erickson. It's 8:47 now. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. On the phone with me now, Tom Kelly from the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association. Good morning, Tom.
Well, good morning, Leslie.
So let's start.
Weird day out there, huh?
Yeah. Rain. Well, it's snowing here in Old Town, but looks like rain any place lower. Anyway, let's start off. Of course, the World Championships taking place in St. Moritz, Switzerland, underway. Who to look for here from Team USA?
Well, it was a big opening day at the World Championships in St. Moritz. It was the women's Super G today, the first opportunity for Lindsey Vonn to go head-to-head with Lara Goot. Did not go exactly as Lindsey had anticipated. She had a pretty good lead going, and about mid-course just went a little bit too straight, skied off course, no crash, nothing, but no finish for her. Top American was Lauren Ross in 14th place. Nicole Schmidhoffer of Austria picking up the win. Lara Goot, the hometown favorite, picking up the bronze medal. So good opening day race, but not so good for Lindsey Vonn.
Okay, so with Ted Ligety, Bodie Miller out, Steve Nyman out, I mean, do we have a hope at getting any medals here?
Well, Lindsey for sure is a hope, and Super G has not been her strongest discipline since coming back. She's been much stronger in downhill, so we'll get to see her go out on Sunday in the women's downhill. Michaela Schifrin as well will be a factor in both the giant slalom and the slalom coming up at the end of next week. Beyond that, it's going to be, you know, kind of tough going, but certainly a few medal hopes with Michaela and with Lindsey as we move forward. But it is tough with the injuries this year. Should be a great World Championships. This is an amazing course. We were there in 2003. Bodie Miller was the star of those games. Bodie actually doing the commentary for NBC. All of the events will be streamed live, and most of them broadcast live. This morning's was broadcast live on NBCSN. So if you're an American fan, you'll find it easy to get coverage of the World Championships this year.
Okay, let's move through it then. Cross country, they were in South Korea.
Yeah, we're going to see a string of Olympic test events coming up right now. Cross country was there last weekend, Nordic Combined as well, although we did not have any U.S. skiers go to the Nordic Combined event. But on the cross country side, first opportunity to test out the venue at Alpensia. Three straight podium days for the USA. Ida Sargent having a career first podium, finishing third in the classic sprint on Friday, and then coming back Saturday with Stephen finishing second on the podium. Caitlin Patterson fourth. Liz Guinney from Park City with a career best 13th place finish in the skiathlon. And then in the team sprint, it was Ida Sargent teaming up with Sophie Caldwell. They finished second in the sprint. Caitlin Patterson, Liz Stephen in fourth, and Simi Hamilton and Annie Newell coming in fourth as well. Field not full World Cup size, but the podium is a podium, and we'll take it. Athletes really had a good experience there. For any of you that watched it, these courses are absolutely staggeringly difficult. So that's going to be a factor, and it's going to be, for sure, a great Olympics next year for cross country.
All right. Then we had the Grand Prix in Mammoth, and I saw that weather really took its toll on this one, huh?
Yeah, it was really a disaster weather-wise. You know, when it snows in Mammoth, it's a big deal. And boy, it snowed and snowed over the weekend. We actually did not get all of the events in, but what we did, actually in the halfpipe snowboarding contest, pretty interesting results. Kelly Clark winning on the women's side. Chloe Kim had been leading after qualifying, but she was unable to stay for the reschedule, which was Sunday. She actually is in Korea right now with the State Department doing a tour of 1 year out from the Olympics. But Sean White picking up a win on the men's half pipe, his first major win in a few years. He was very, very happy with that, especially coming off a very disappointing X Games. In slopestyle snowboarding, Jamie Anderson on the women's side, the Olympic champion, winning as usual. But a new face on the men's side, 16-year-old Red Gerard from Colorado picking up his first major event win. And then in halfpipe skiing, Torin Yeter Wallace picking up the win there. And in slopestyle skiing, Maggie Boyson picking up the win for the USA. So a little bit of a dicey weekend, but we got most of the events in, and those athletes will be moving on. Olympic test events coming up in about another week on the halfpipe side. So Sean White, Kelly Clark, Chloe Kim and company, they'll be over in Phoenix Park in Pyeongchang for the Olympic test.
And a huge and very successful event over in Soldier Hollow and at the UOP with the Nordic Junior World Championships.
Yeah, I think like all of the volunteers and everyone else, we are all in recovery mode after an amazing event the last 7 or 8 days. The Junior Nordic World Championships are being held in the U.S. for the first time in 30 years. Over 500 athletes from nearly 40 nations taking part. Events at the Utah Olympic Park and at Soldier Hollow. Spectacular results on the cross-country side. First medals ever in history. Catherine Ogden last week winning a bronze medal in the skiathlon event. That was the first medal ever won by a cross-country skier from the U.S. in the Junior Nordic World Championships. And then the women's relay team coming back and winning a spectacular bronze medal on Sunday. A goal that these girls had set out over a year and a half ago to come to this event here, to put on their relay socks and to emulate their role models from the World Cup. And what a great job they did in winning that bronze medal.
So call me suspicious, and also fresh off of a screening of the Sundance documentary Icarus, but I saw the Russian team sweeping two races, I think the 10 and 15K, 2 days in a row. Do we do drug testing at this level?
Yeah, there was drug testing. You know, it's an interesting question. And one of the things that we did last week is we did an educational session with the president and CEO of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, the highly renowned USADA, probably one of the most sophisticated anti-doping agencies of any of the national teams in the world. Travis Tigert gave a presentation to around 100 athletes on Wednesday, very well received, a lot of interest in athletes, and was attended by probably a dozen nations, including the Russians, which was really a good sign. But, you know, when you're in that athletic environment, the Russians were dominating. You don't really have any indication that anything's being done wrong. There was the blood testing, there was doping control at the event last week. So there's really no way to tell, but I think you also get an opportunity in an environment like that to look at them as athletes. And over the course of that week, we got to know those Russian athletes. We got to know their accomplishments. We got to see them in action. And, you know, we have no way of knowing. And I don't know that you carry with yourself a lot of suspicion in those situations. But what you are doing is seeing them as people and as athletes. And, you know, hopefully they're clean in those events. And it was a fair playing field, but there was testing. And if there was anything going on, that would come out in the testing.
Well, that's exactly what the film Icarus shows, is that there's lots of doping going on in the testing, and they have found a way around the testing, but we'll leave it at that. Finally, just need to wrap up with the Deer Valley Freestyle International, another just huge crowds here.
Yeah, that just continues to be the most popular event on the entire tour. Over 10,000 spectators there on Saturday night for dual moguls. It's just a great show for the athletes. Pretty good year for the USA. Morgan Schill kicking it off with a win in the moguls competition on Thursday night. Individual moguls and Kylie McKinnon coming back in a very challenging aerials event on Friday night. Qualifications was really, really tough with the wind and the snow and the blowing snow that evening. Ashley Caldwell not making it through to finals. And then on Saturday in the dual modes competition, really deep night for the USA. Only one podium out of it, Jalen Koff picking up a third place finish as she did last year in this event. But really, really strong night, though, for the USA. If you look at the results and see the number of athletes in the top six and top eight, a lot of athletes just about ready to pop through. Unfortunately, one podium coming from Jalen.
Okay, Tom, thanks. Well, coming up tomorrow, starting at noon at the PC Mark, it's time for the free lunch and learn. In the studio to tell us more about that, attorney Natalie Scull, along with Colt Johnson from the PC Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Leslie.
I'm here to invite the community to our free lunchtime learning tomorrow from 12 to 1 p.m. at the PC Mark and to introduce our guest speaker, Natalie Siegel.
Okay, Natalie, so you're going to be talking about what's the state of your estate?
Yes, Leslie. I'm going to be talking with the community about the documents that everyone needs to protect themselves in the event that someone dies in their family or that just to protect their assets and their heirs.
Okay, so does this go beyond a will? Are we talking like medical directives and things like
yes,
that?
Yes, Leslie. I'll be talking about wills. Talking about some trusts, revocable and irrevocable, the difference between those, and also the Utah Advanced Healthcare Directive, which is the living will, and financial powers of attorney.
Okay. So is this required? I mean, is an attorney needed for all of this?
No, Leslie. Actually, there are a few of those documents that can be done on your own. I would recommend that if you are going to go to the trouble of having a trust that you have an attorney draft that. But the healthcare directive, financial powers of attorney, and wills, a lot of people are doing those online now.
Okay. So easy enough, but you'll just kind of run through what is really needed by anybody, huh?
Yes. And also be running through the statutory requirements to make those documents legal.
And can you just run
invalid.
Through some of that?
Well,
people think of doing their own.
Yeah, typically with the will, you're going to need two witnesses, and that will is going to be notarized in order for it to be valid. So I will go through some of those requirements and just give people a general overview of what's required to have some good binding valid documents in the state of Utah.
Okay, and then with the medical directive, this is in the event, so say maybe you're in a car accident or something where you can't decide for yourself. But is this, I think what why people hold off on doing this is like, well, I mean, if there was a chance for me to come out of the coma or something like that, I mean, it just seems so final.
Well, the form that the Utah Medical Association in conjunction with the Utah State Bar has put out, there are some provisions that you can write in to say, you know, if I'm in a coma for 2 months, then please take me off life support. So there are ways to execute this document now and have those protections in there. And I'm going to hand that document out tomorrow and we'll go over that.
Okay. Anything else that you want people to know?
No, I just encourage those interested in doing estate planning or thinking about estate planning, or if you have an estate plan and you'd like to ask some questions about what you have, to come tomorrow.
Okay. Good information. Natalie and Cole, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.